Session 7 is about how to help your teen succeed on the ACT or SAT. Now, this topic often provides quite a bit of stress to parents, mostly because it's unnecessarily complicated. Not only are there two tests, the ACT and the SAT, but there's also the subject tests, and there are many different opinions about what, where, how to take these tests. So I'm going to provide a simple outline, and then I'm going to discuss how a student can truly improve his or her test score quickly. And then I'm going to cover some of the most commonly asked questions that parents have so that you walk away with a real plan about how to help your child succeed on these tests. In the workbook, you will see at the top of session 7 that I have listed the months that both the SAT and the subject tests are offered and when the ACT is offered. You'll also see that the SAT and subject tests are offered in December, March, May, June, August, October, and November. That's 7 times, basically, from December of junior year all the way through November of senior year. The ACT test dates are very similar. They're on different weeks, though, and sometimes different months than the SAT. They are December, February, April, June, July, September, and October. You will see in the book that July has an asterisk because, for whatever reason, the July test is not offered in New York or California. Now, it's important to note that the SAT subject test and the SAT are offered the same day, so a student cannot take both in one test setting. But as you will hear me explain in a bit, most colleges do not require the subject test. So for most students, this will be a moot point and they can focus entirely on the SAT if that's the best test for them. Now, the first question the parents want to know is, well, which is the better test for my son or daughter? And what I advise is that in the summer before 11th grade, a student takes a full-length SAT and a full-length ACT on separate weekends to figure out which test is better for them. Now, an average student, if I give them an SAT and an ACT, will generally score the same on both tests. But certain students will score substantially better on one over the other. And the good news is that colleges do not have a preference for one test versus another. So if a student scores, say, substantially better on the ACT, then he or she will never have to take the SAT again. If they score similarly on both tests, well, a student generally has one test that they like more than the other, and then they can start with that test. But the only way to truly figure it out is to take a diagnostic test in each. Now, there are companies who provide free diagnostic tests, and you can call up and find ones in your local area. In the research page in the guidebook at the end of this session, I give some suggestions of books and companies that will help you with this. But for the most part, there's usually a test prep company in every city that will offer a free test. The key is that you make sure they're real past tests, because some test prep companies write their own tests, and this can be problematic for a variety of reasons I won't cover here. Let's just make sure that they're real past tests, because that will end up producing a real score that will be similar to what a student will get on the real thing. Now, speaking of past tests, the actual key to improving one's score is to actually practice taking real past tests. That's a lot of times I've said real past tests. Okay, there are actually 3 books. One is created by the people who make the ACT, and 2 are created by the people who make the SAT and the subject tests. And each of them have full-length practice tests, again, written by the test makers themselves. One is called the Official ACT Prep Guide. One is called the Official SAT Study Guide. And then there's one called the Official Study Guide for All SAT Subject Tests. So regardless of how a student prepares, whether it be with a tutor, in a class, or online, or by themselves, the key is to work on these practice tests because these tests have patterns. And the more a student practices, the more that they will start to understand the strategies involved in improving their scores. Now, before I get into more details about how a student can improve a score and whether tutors or classes are best for your son or daughter, it's important to discuss the realistic timeline of when to take these tests. Over the last few years, I have seen a tendency among parents to be told that a student should take these tests earlier and earlier to have more time to prepare for them and get them out of the way. And in an adult world, that would seem to make a lot of sense. Hey, why don't you get started sophomore year to give yourself more lead time and take one of the first test dates in junior year? Now, unfortunately, while this would seem like a good idea, I have found it's not actually how teenagers work. And I'll give you an example of a student that illustrates this point. I had a boy who, when he was in 10th grade, was ranked the #1 Guitar Hero player in the world. He literally locked himself in his room most of his sophomore year and played hours and hours of Guitar Hero until he was able to complete levels perfectly that no one ever had before. Now, at the same time, he was a straight A student, so his parents didn't have to yank the system out of his room. But I want you to keep this in mind to understand his psychology. Now, back when I was still doing test prep, I was teaching him the ACT. And this was a boy who was incredibly good at math, but he almost never read a book. So his math score was decent, but his reading score was pretty bad. Now, I started preparing him in the beginning of his junior year, but actually your child could wait all the way until January of junior year, depending on their schedule. So I started preparing him to take the test, the ACT, in April of his junior year. Well, he got a little bit better, but he really wasn't engaged. He was a junior boy, and as I mentioned, he wasn't totally keyed into going to college yet. And so he was sort of half-assing the work and got a score of a 25 the first time he took it. Now, this isn't a bad score, it just wasn't what he was capable of. And the truth is that for the first time a student takes a test, it rarely reflects their ability, because they have to go to a strange school that they're not familiar with and stand in line with hundreds of other students, so they can kind of freak out. Therefore, I always say that the first real test for most students is a throwaway test. It's basically a practice exam to get them exposed to the testing center and what it's like to take the test. Now, the second time he took it was in June of 11th grade. But the problem with June is that the ACT falls right after APs and is usually right in the midst of finals. Additionally, in between April and June, this boy got a driver's license and a girlfriend. And no matter how cool and funny I might be or think that I am, I can't compete with that. So the boy wasn't really preparing up to the level that he could. And so he got a 26, which meant he went up 1 point. Now, his parents called me and said, Danny, you know, we're kind of concerned. He wants to go to WashU in St. Louis, and he's going to need a much better score than he's getting right now. He loves you, but his score's not going up. Should we get another tutor? And I said, I'm about to put my reputation on the line and tell you the following. Your son is going to freak out somewhere between August or September when he has that oh crap moment, and he's going to come back to me and really start digging in. Well, it took until the beginning of September, and the boy came back to me and said, Danny, how many practice tests do you have? I said, I don't know, 20? Why? He said, because I'm not leaving my room until I beat the reading section. He added, I'm not going to let this be the reason why I don't get into WashU. And of course, I'm thinking, aha, there it is. And this boy did exactly what he said he was going to do. He spent the remainder of the summer and half of fall doing nothing but reading comprehension until he went from a 26 to a 33, which is incredible. But it was only because he finally made the decision to commit himself to it. And the reason that I knew he would do this is because he was the kid who dedicated himself to becoming the best at something, but only if it was on his terms. So I knew I couldn't get him to do it until he decided that he wanted to do it. Now, ideally, he would have gotten the test out of the way much earlier. But like I said, a teenager timeline is often different than an adult timeline. So I would say 65 to 70% of my students every year don't get the test score they want until the fall of their senior year. And that's totally okay. Now, there are some highly motivated students who will study in the summer before their junior year and get it done in one or two times. And that's amazing. But I wouldn't have that expectation if you're a parent. There are also kids who are just naturally good at the test and can walk into the ACT and get a 35 or a 36, and we hate those kids. No, I'm just kidding. That's great too. But I want you to be realistic in your expectations about making a plan, especially if you're hiring a tutor. Because if you know that your son or daughter is absolutely not engaged, you want to be able to spend money when it's actually going to be worthwhile. So you might want to find a tutor or a company that's flexible and maybe comes back a few times during the course of the year to prepare the student when he or she is totally ready. And remember, the student literally has 6 or 7 times to take these exams, so they have time. Now, most students will not take the test more than 3 or 4 times. In fact, my general rule is that if a student hasn't gotten the score that he or she wants by test 4, they're not going to get it by test 5. Now, I tell students that there is a secret to improving their score quickly, and typically, everyone's really interested in knowing what it is. You want to know what it is? Okay, well, it took me probably 10 years of working with students to really understand the secret and why it works. Most students do what I call passive learning, which means that they go to a class, or they work out of a book, or they're studying online, or they have a tutor, and there's an assignment that they have to do. Let's say they have to take a practice SAT section in math. And so they do it, and they try, but then they just wait to go to class, or they wait for their tutor to explain their mistakes. And there's nothing wrong with that. It does work. But what I like to do is several things. One, I like to have students start taking practice sections untimed. If I'm teaching a student how to do, say, the science section of the ACT, I don't want to stress that student out more by introducing time, because often students can't finish in time, and so they're not able to demonstrate their full potential. And then they start to question their abilities, and then they're already in a negative self-talk loop where they don't believe that they can do it. So instead, I strip out the time and say, look, I want you to take this science practice section untimed, and I don't care if it takes you 3 days. I want you to try your best and try to do every single question and get it right. Now, they're obviously going to still miss a lot, and they're not going to get a perfect score, but they're going to get closer to what their actual potential is by not being freaked out by the time limit. Does that make sense? Now, once they start to feel confident and they start to understand how the questions work, then I will introduce the time and they can start to work on bringing back up their scores. In other words, say they were getting a 29 on the science section untimed. Well, as soon as I introduce the time, their score is going to drop. But at least they know psychologically that they're capable of getting that original 29 and so believe that they can get back to it eventually. And the next key is that when a student does a practice section, I want them to do quality over quantity. So there are some test prep people who believe that a student should take a practice test every weekend. And while that's not necessarily a bad idea, I don't like to do it in the beginning because the student's going to get burned out and they're not actually learning why they're getting the questions right or wrong because there's no time to really review their mistakes. They're just taking a practice test, going it over quickly, and taking another practice test. What I want is for students to understand the test. So what I have a student do is take a section and mark the questions they got wrong by using the answers in the back of the book. Then I want them to come back a different time and spend 20 or 30 minutes going over the wrong answers and asking themselves, why did I get this wrong? Now that I know what the right answer is, did I get it wrong because I didn't read a passage carefully? Is it because I went too fast? And they're going to start to see that probably half their mistakes are silly mistakes, and they're going to get angry with themselves. And I want that. I want a student to get angry because then their brain is going to recognize that tendency and stop doing it in the future. I also want students to believe and start to understand that they can actually do even better than they thought that they could do. And that's what happens when I have students grade their own work before they meet their tutor or go to class. Once they then meet their tutor or go to class or learn a lesson online, they can then review the questions they truly don't understand and have someone explain it to them. But instead of just passively learning, I'm getting students to also actively learn on their own. Now, of course, the key to this is getting a student motivated enough to do it. But what ends up happening is that students will start to increase their score faster and consequently start to become proud of themselves. This encourages them to want to do it more because they actually see themselves progressing. And in the guide, you will see that I've broken the next page into 4 different sections. The first one I've already addressed, which is about timing. But to review, most students will take a diagnostic practice test or 2 in the summer before their junior year. Now, I know that some people use the PSAT or the PACT, in other words, the practice that they give in school. They use those tests as diagnostic tests. But I often still have students take full-length tests because the PSAT that they took in the beginning of 10th grade was before they learned another year of math and spent another year reading. So in the summer after sophomore year, a student is going to be in a completely different place than they were at the beginning of sophomore year. Additionally, the problem with the PSAT in 11th grade is that you don't get the scores back until December. That's why I would advise a student to just suck it up and go on 2 different weekends to take a full-length practice test of each exam. Then a student will typically begin preparing either at the end of summer before junior year or within the fall of junior year to get ready to be able to take the first SAT or the ACT in either December, February, or March. Now, if there's a situation where a student is thoroughly committed to something, sports, theater, whatever it is, and just doesn't have the time in the fall quarter, it's okay to take the first ACT in April or the first SAT in May. Again, they will still have 4 or 5 test dates left. Now, the other thing that I want to mention is that if a student is applying early action or early decision to a college, the deadline is typically November 1st or November 15th for those schools. This means that a student's last available test date that will still count for an early action or early decision program is October for the ACT and November for the SAT. Now you might ask, well, that doesn't make any sense. How could a student take the November SAT and still have it count if the application is due in November? Well, a student can still have the October ACT or the November SAT be considered if they pre-send the scores when they register. So when you register for the ACT or the SAT, you will see a section where you can designate an early action or early decision college to get that test score as soon as it's available. In other words, the day that the student gets the score report, the college will get it as well. Now, you're going to want to check with any early action or early decision school to make sure that this is true for them. But most of the time, I have seen that the October ACT or the November SAT will still count if you pre-send it, even if a school's website might say otherwise. So make sure you call. Now, a student can even go so far as to take the SAT or ACT in December for a regular decision school. In other words, they can go all the way to December of their senior year and still have it be considered. But again, you want to check with each individual college on your son or daughter's list to make sure, just so that you don't get surprised. Now, let me address again taking the test multiple times. Like I mentioned, the average number of times a student will take the exam is usually 2 to 3, but there's no problem taking it a fourth time. But if a student doesn't get it by number 4, usually a fifth time won't help. It should be noted, however, that the ACT has a system in place where a student can completely delete a score from their record, and I've included exactly how to do this in the resources. So for example, if a student suddenly gets sick right before the ACT and then goes in and bombs or knows that he or she bombed it, then they can either tell the ACT immediately after not to grade the test or what's called invalidate the score, but then they'll never see how they did. Or they can wait and see the score and then write to delete it if necessary. Remember, the ACT allows you to delete a score from a record permanently. The SAT does not. Now, a lot of parents will ask me, well, what if my son or daughter gets a worse score on a later test? Will that hurt his or her chances? And my answer is generally no. Let's say a student got a 28 on the ACT and then took it again and got a 25. Well, the lower score typically won't matter because the student already got a 28 and that's what a college is going to use. Additionally, the ACT has true score choice, which means that you have to go into each ACT test date and send it separately, which means that you can essentially control the scores anyway. Having said that, there are certain universities that really want to see all your test scores no matter what. And if a school does have this policy, I do suggest generally sending all the test score dates because, again, it's not going to hurt a student if they have a lower score on the record. The college is going to use the best one. Now, the SAT works slightly differently. When you go to send the SAT scores, the College Board website is going to show all of a student's scores on the same page. Now, they do have something called score choice, and for each college, the College Board will tell you their policy. Some schools will say that they want all the scores, while other schools will allow you to uncheck the boxes of the scores that you don't want to send, so you only have to send the best scores. Now, I know that's confusing, so hang in there because it gets even a little bit even worse. Some colleges do what's called super scoring. And super scoring is where colleges take the best individual sections from different tests. So if a student took the SAT 2 times and scored higher on math on one test and higher on the verbal on the other, some colleges will mix the two scores to come up with a new composite score that's higher, otherwise known as a super score. Of course, the trick is that not all colleges do this. And there are many schools that superscore the SAT more than they do the ACT. Ugh. So, again, if you want to know for sure, all you have to do is type in the name of a college and the word standardized test policies into Google, and it will tell you whether a college superscores the SAT and the ACT, and whether they require the test be sent, or all the tests be sent. At the end of the day, however, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Just try to have your child take a test until he or she can get the best possible score and then send those scores. Finally, a note about subject tests. Subject tests have true score choice, which means that if your son or daughter takes a subject test or multiple tests and bombs all of them, they don't need to send any of them. You are not required to send subject test scores to anyone. Therefore, there's no downside to taking them. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So let's first discuss the deal with tutoring. There are typically 4 ways a student can prepare for the SAT or ACT. 1 is with a tutor. 2 is a group class. 3 is online. And 4 is on a student's own by using prep books. And the truth is that all 4 work if a student takes it seriously. Now, my family couldn't afford tutors, so I tried to study out of a Princeton Review book, and I remember falling asleep every Saturday trying to study for it. Nevertheless, the information was still in there. So it really just depends on a student's learning style and level of motivation. Now, a student can always use one preparation method and then change later on. So for example, if a student tries a class and they aren't getting anything out of it, I would suggest to stop doing it and try something else. The same thing goes for tutors. Many parents think that they've hired this company that's sending two tutors to their house, and since their son likes one of them for the verbal section, say, they won't stir the pot when he doesn't like the one for math. I would say you could call the company anyway and have them switch the other tutor. I also like to advise that if you're going to go with a tutor or a class, see if you can find one that has a trial period, or your child can do a session without you making a full financial commitment to see if your son or daughter really connects with the tutor. At the end of the day, the strategies in a book or in a class or from a tutor are all the same, but how they're communicated and how a tutor motivates a student is a different story. So depending on your financial resources and depending on where you live and depending on what's available, just know that all of them work as long as the student puts in the time. And finally, I want to talk a little bit more about the SAT subject tests. Now, these bad boys used to be called the SAT-2s or the achievement tests back in the day. And like I mentioned, most colleges no longer require the subject test, even some of the best schools in the country. So if you look at, say, Stanford's standardized testing policy, it says that it would recommend two subject tests, but if a student does not submit subject tests, it will not hurt them in any way in terms of evaluating the application. This means that if a student does well on the subject tests, and I mean by scoring at least over 700, but really over 730 out of 800, then they should send the scores. If a student does not reach this score for a selective school like Stanford, then it probably isn't worth sending because a lot of the students will be submitting really excellent scores. Well, the good news is that most of the 4,000 schools in the U.S. no longer require subject tests, including colleges such as USC, Michigan, Tulane, Emory, UCLA, the University of Texas. In other words, they're not nearly as important as they once were. Now, there are a few colleges that still require them or at least strongly recommend them. For example, Georgetown has always wanted three subject tests. Now, they will take two, but if you ask them whether they really want to see three subject test scores, they're going to tell you, well, we don't require any, but our strongest candidates submit three. This tells you that if your child can get three good test scores to submit, they should really do it. Now, Harvard also doesn't require them, but they would really like them unless a student has a financial hardship and cannot take them. So, if your son or daughter is looking at the top 10 most selective schools in the country, you definitely want to check whether they require a subject test. However, for the other 99% of the students out there, they don't have to worry about it. And remember that if they do have to take the subject test, they are typically taken in May or June of a student's junior year or at the end of the year they've had a subject. So for example, if a student takes AP Biology as a class in sophomore year, it makes sense for them to take the biology subject test in May or June of their sophomore year because that's right after the student covered all the material. Having said that, subject tests such as literature can really be taken anytime because it's not necessarily subject dependent. A student isn't going to forget how to read, so you can plan accordingly if your son or daughter actually has to take these tests. Finally, I want to remind everyone that in the guidebook for this section, I have created a resource page that lists the most important resources you can use for all of these tests, including the places where to register for the SAT and the ACT. And remember, students should send the scores to colleges directly from these websites. Now, this requirement is actually starting to change, where students can just put the scores on in the application, but I still recommend sending them in. I've also included the best prep guides and resources for you to get help. And I've included links to the instructions for applying for extra time or other accommodations for students who have learning differences or a disability. And finally, I've included the instructions for deleting an ACT score if that's something that comes up for you. Well, I hope this has been helpful, and I can't wait to see you in session 8.